and see this Jesus that John paints a picture of in multiple ways. And he gives us this imagery of Jesus as the creator in John 1 and verse 1 and the few verses following that. He tells us that Jesus is the Son of God. We looked at that last week. That he is the King of Israel. That he is the Word of God. That he is the Lamb of God. We have contained within the Scriptures, and specifically within the Gospel of John, this is John's purpose, is to show us who Jesus really is. So many in the world today have a misguided view of who Jesus is. We need to present this to them. Just say, come and see. Anybody can invite to a Bible reading together, to a Bible study together, to a Bible discussion, to the church services, whatever. You can say, come and see. You can say about the singing Thursday night, come and see what we do and what this is all about. Come and see. John says in John 20 and verse 30, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And so he tells us what his purpose of writing is, and he spends the time selecting various cycles of his life, various scenarios in his life, just a few, not very many at all. And he's focuses on signs. This word sign is unique to the Gospel of John, or rather, he emphasizes that word more than he does the word miracles. And the reason why I believe he does that is, like he says there in John 20, in verse 30 and 31, that signs point to something. That signs are a message. Signs are not there just to be admired because of the miraculous nature of it, but signs are there to give us a message. If you were to be driving down the road and you see this red octagonal sign with white letters that spell out the word stop, and you just go right through that sign without stopping, and a cop sees you, he's going to pull you over and he's going to say, did you not see the sign? And you may say, yes, I saw the sign. Beautiful red color, nice shape, not messed up in any way, yet bright, easy to see. Yeah, I saw the sign. Why didn't you stop? The sign is not to be admired because it's a sign. The sign is there to send a message. And so these signs that Jesus performs in the Gospel of John are there to support this message that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that you may believe, and by believing you may have life in his name. The very first of these signs that Jesus performs is found in John chapter 2 in the first 12 verses, where they are at Cana in Galilee. Cana was a very small town that was west of the Sea of Galilee. It was not right there on the Sea of Galilee like Capernaum was, or some of the other cities that you are familiar with in Jesus' life. Cana was close to Nazareth, his hometown. And they are at a wedding, it says in verse 1. And I want to just give you a quick overview of something here. This is called the Cana cycle, because here in chapter 2, verse 1 through 12, you have this miracle that takes place, this sign that takes place at Cana. But then notice the geography, notice the movement of Jesus as John portrays this. In verse 13 and following, you have him go to Jerusalem. And here you have the segment about the cleansing of the temple. And then in chapter 3, somewhere in the vicinity of Jerusalem, Judea, most likely, you have Nicodemus that comes and talks to him by night. And in chapter 4, he is making his way back to Galilee when he meets the woman at the well in Samaria. And then by the time you get to the end of chapter 4, beginning in verse 46, look where he is again. He is at Cana. This is the end of the Cana cycle. So chapters 2, 3, and 4 contain this cycle that includes a couple of miracles and include a couple of these signs, to use John's terminology, and some discussions with people. And so you have this inclusio, this at the beginning at Cana and end at Cana. And I'm going to come back to this in just a moment, but what we have to ask ourselves is, why does John write this way? What is it that John is trying to do? We know his purpose is to get us to believe in who Jesus is. And with that in mind, there are a lot of things that John does, and all the New Testament authors do this to some degree, a lot of things that he does that has nothing to do with chronology, that has nothing to do with order of events, but rather with the theme, with a purpose in his writing and making a point. Next week, I will be talking about verses 13 through 22, the cleansing of the temple, and I will go ahead and give you a teaser here and let you know that there is a lot of controversy at times about the cleansing of the temple. John puts it at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. The other three Gospels put it at the end of Jesus' ministry. Which is it? We're so concerned about the order. John's not concerned about that. He places it there to make a point, and we'll talk about that next week. But this miracle that he performs, this sign that he performs of turning the water to wine, most of you are probably familiar with this sign. Have you ever wondered why? What was the purpose of him turning water to wine? You know, there's a lot that can be discussed here, and a lot of people get bogged down into some of these details about just how many gallons of water that there were in these six stone pots, and so therefore how much wine he made, and, you know, was this alcoholic wine, non-alcoholic wine? Were these people getting drunk? Was Jesus condoning drunkenness or social drinking? And all that's not what this is about, and so we're not even going to go there. That's not what John was writing about. And we can get bogged down into the what, that is, the what of the sign, that we forget to take a look at the who behind the sign. John writes this so that we can see the who, so we can see the why, so we can see that Jesus performs this, and what does this say about Jesus? At the very beginning of his gospel, he introduces us to an idea: the connection of Jesus with creation. In John 1 and verse 1, he says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." And we talked about how reminiscent that was of Genesis 1 and verse 1 and following. And I would suggest to you that chapters 2, 3, and 4 follow up on that theme. And what John is wanting us to see is, in the words of Paul in 2 Corinthians 5:17, is that Jesus is the one who makes all things new. That with his miracle, with turning the water to wine, with the cleansing of the temple, with the discussion of Nicodemus about being born again, with the Samaritan woman and the water, the living water that he can provide, and with the healing of the nobleman's son, you all have this theme that Jesus is the one that can make all things new. So let's begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 2. "On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, 'They have no wine.' And Jesus said to her, 'Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come.' His mother said to the servants, 'Do whatever he tells you.' Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, 'Fill the jars with water.' And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, 'Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast.' So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, The master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The first thing that I think we need to understand from this is, again, this is not just some demonstration of power. This is not, and I don't believe that he is simply doing this because, oh, well, we're out of wine. Guess what? I can make some wine. You know, we need wine. I can do that. It's not like they could just go down to the store really quickly and buy a bunch of wine for the wedding. And so he says, well, I'll just use my power. And is it that Mary, his mother, is saying, you know what, Jesus, I know you've got the power to do this, so how about you help us out here? No, that's not what it's about at all. Rather, this goes back to this theme of he is able to make all things new. And so the first thing I want us to see is that Jesus brought something new, something better. And there is great symbolism in everything that John is writing about in all of these stories of Jesus. There is a tremendous amount of symbolism. In fact, even the mention of the third day in verse 1 has caused people to wonder, well, what does John mean by that? There's some symbolism in the third day. Well, when you hear that term, as a Christian, what do you think of? You think of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, do you not? Could it be that John is making a reference? Now, he is giving a time reference here. He is talking about a particular week in Jesus' life, but by using on the third day, is he making some other point as well? I don't know for sure, but it could be that he is talking about the resurrection here, and so he's just connecting all that. However, if you go back to chapter 1, you may have picked up on this as we were going through this chapter over the last few sermons, and that is that beginning in verse 29, you have three times in a row where John says, the next day. So in verses 19 through 28, you have a day when John the Baptist is discussing or is being asked all these questions about who he is. And then in verse 29, you have the next day. And then in verse 35, the next day. And then in verse 43, the next day. And then in verse 1 of chapter 2, on the third day. So what John the Apostle could be doing here is if you count up the days, you come up with, depending upon how you count, either 6 or 7 days. Well, both of those numbers have significance. 7, as you know, is a number in Jewish thinking that symbolizes completeness. 7 goes back to the creation week. Creation has been discussed since the very beginning of this gospel. And then, of course, with what is going on here in this sign that he performs, there is a creation taking place. And so it could be that he is not specifically talking about literal days here, but he is relating this kind of to the creation week where you have Jesus, God through Jesus, working and then a sign performed on the seventh day to demonstrate this creation and what he is bringing. 6 is the number of incompleteness. If 7 demonstrates completeness, 6 is a number that is incomplete. How many stone water jars were there that Jesus tells them to fill with water? There were 6. And what were these water jars used for? These stone jars used for? He tells us specifically. Why does he point this out? Why does John give us this information? He is not a newspaper reporter. John is not here to give a line-by-line description, just newspaper style of facts. He is making theological points. And in chapter 2 and verse 6, it says, now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification. These were used to help with those particular rituals of cleansing of utensils and so forth. And the reason that they were stone was because underneath the old law, stone was a material that was used that the contents within that vessel, the water within that vessel, could not become contaminated like it could be if it was earthenware. Stone was not as porous. And so you have a reference there to the old order, to the Jewish system. And what does Jesus do with this? He takes these stone jars that are representative of the Jewish order, the Jewish system. He fills it with water and he turns that water to wine and brings something new. He creates something new. This is pointing towards, now it's not explicit, but as you go through the history of Jesus, as you go through the gospel, that's exactly what we see going on, is Jesus is slowly bringing things that are new and doing away with things that are old. And it's not just that there's something new, but it's better. In verse 10, the master of the feast says to the bridegroom, and the master of the feast would be the one who was in charge of making sure that everybody had everything they needed, all the guests, their wine jars were filled at all times and had everything they needed for the feast. And he says, everyone serves the good wine first. And when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. Of course, he didn't know what happened. He didn't know the story behind this. But he just is making a common sense point that they would have understood in their culture that you're not going to serve the bad stuff first. You're not going to save the best for last. No, you give everybody the good stuff, and then when they run out, if that starts to run out, then you can serve the bad stuff. We have people in our home once a month for what we call the birthversary party, where everybody with birthdays or anniversaries that month is invited to our home to celebrate. Now, we do ask, of course, that y'all help chip in and you bring certain items. We have you sign up for that. If you've been there, then you know what I'm talking about. But if for some reason we miscalculated or you didn't bring everything that you said that you were going to bring or you didn't bring enough or whatever, and we have more people there than expected, and we run out of food of what y'all brought, well, guess what we're going to do? We're going to be going into the pantry and we're going to be trying to find something. It may be nothing more than a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but we'll feed you. It may be a bowl of cereal, but we'll feed you. It may not be the best, but we'll give you something. And that's the point that the master of the feast is saying is, you're normally going to serve the best wine first, but if you start to run out, if that's gone, then you come back out with the lower quality wine. But you've saved the best until now. Well, what is Jesus doing here? He's saying, I'm bringing something that is new. We're doing away with the old system, the old Jewish order, and I'm bringing something that is much better. Hebrews goes into great detail about this. We're not going to turn there tonight, but if you know anything about the book of Hebrews, you know one word that can define the entire book that is the theme of the book of Hebrews, and it's the word better. That Jesus is better than the angels. He's better than Moses. He brings a better covenant. He brings better everything, better promises. And Jesus, in this very visible demonstration, is saying, I am bringing something new, and I'm bringing something better. And the entire Cana cycle of chapters 2, 3, and 4 make this point. Without going into detail, just take a look again at the topics, the various situations that are that John points out to us. And you can make this connection on your own. The cleansing of the temple, and he says himself in verse 19 that he is the temple. He is bringing something better. When he talks to Nicodemus about being born again, there's a new creation, once again, and something that is better. And when he talks to the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman at the well, there is water, new water, better water than what she could draw from Jacob's well. And the other sign in Cana at the end of chapter 4, you have him heal this son of his who was at the point of death. And so you have a creation of sorts, something new and better. And so Jesus is saying, this is what I can do, and this is what I am bringing. This is what this is about. This is not about filling immediate physical needs. I'm taking this opportunity to teach a lesson about what I am bringing. And another point that I believe is attested to not only in this section, but also even in chapter 3, as we'll see in just a moment, and in the broader language of the scriptures, and that is that Jesus is the bridegroom who can provide the wine needed for the messianic banquet. I don't think it's by any chance, just by happenstance, that he does this at a wedding. You're familiar with the language of scripture and how Jesus is the bridegroom and the church is his bride, and this feast that is taking place when they are united. Matthew chapter 22 uses this language. If you want to turn over there very briefly, Matthew chapter 22, and beginning in verse 1, you have this parable that Jesus speaks to them regarding the kingdom and comparing it to a wedding feast. Matthew 22, beginning I'll begin in verse 2. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son and sent his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding feast, but they would not come. Again, he sent other servants saying, tell those who were invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast. But they paid no attention and went off, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his servants, treated them shamefully and killed them. The king was angry and he sent his troops and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. Then he said to his servants, the wedding feast is ready, but those invited were not worthy. Go therefore to the main roads and invite to the wedding feast as many as you find. And those servants went out into the roads and gathered all whom they found, both bad and good, so the wedding hall was filled with guests. You have this invitation to a feast, and this is not the only place in the New Testament where this language is used, where you have the idea of God communing with his people in the setting of a feast. And Jesus is presented as the bridegroom and the church as his bride. But this is a wedding where the bridegroom was the one responsible for providing everything. It's not like our society today, where, BJ, you have three girls, and guess what you're going to get to do in the future, Lord willing? You get to pay for three weddings. Or, as I've heard many fathers do, offer your daughter some money to go elope, to just go down to the justice of the peace. That was not the case in the first century. In the first century, you would have been sitting pretty good, BJ, because you wouldn't have had to pay for the wedding. That was the job of the bridegroom. And so he had to provide all these supplies, and the Jewish weddings would last for about a week. Aren't you glad you're not paying for that, BJ? By the way, this helps to answer why so much wine would have been needed. It's not like they were drinking this all in one night. But you have several days of this feast going on. And it was his responsibility to provide the wine, and in such a honor-shame culture, to run out of the supplies for this feast was shameful. It was embarrassing. Jesus is saying, I can provide all that's needed for a wedding feast. one chapter over in the book of John, in John chapter 3, at the end of this chapter, John the Baptist is in a discussion, or some of his disciples, rather, are in discussion about purification. Up comes again this idea of the old Jewish order of things. Look at verse 25. John 3, verse 25. Now a discussion rose between some of John's disciples and a Jew over purification. And they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, he who was with you across the Jordan, to whom you bore witness, look, he is baptizing and all are going to him. And he's talking, of course, about Jesus. John answered, a person cannot receive even one thing unless it is given him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. The one who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is now complete. He must increase, but I must decrease. Jesus, he says, is the bridegroom. He is the one who has the bride. John the Baptist realized that his mission was fading and that he was decreasing and that Jesus, he was beginning his mission, and so therefore he was going to be increasing. He had done his job. He had prepared the way for the bridegroom. And so with this imagery and this metaphor, Jesus is saying, I can provide the wine for the banquet. Come and enjoy this feast with me. Look at the reaction back in John 2 as to after what takes place or after all these things happen. In verse 11, it says, this first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now, when it says manifested his glory, of course, this is not in the full, complete state. That did not happen until later. He said back in verse 4, my hour has not yet come. That is a term that is prevalent in the book of John to talk about the time when he would be manifesting his glory, the time of his death, the time of his resurrection. That had not come just yet. But yet we see little glimpses of his glory here. And the disciples, and by the way, this is, who are his disciples? This is the first week of his ministry. These are the disciples mentioned earlier that were disciples of John the Baptist, and now his disciples, and they see him, and this is done for what reason? To manifest his glory to them so that they will believe in him. Isn't that what John said in John chapter 20 and verse 30 and 31? I'm telling you about these signs so that you may believe in him, and by believing, have everlasting life in his name. We have a choice to make when we are presented with pictures of who Jesus is. John is saying, let me show you. Come and see, and I will show you who Jesus is. What do we do with that? Do we dismiss it and say, well, that can't be right? Do we dismiss it because of the supernatural? Do we dismiss it because, well, you know what, this person over here says this, this person over here says that, and we're influenced by those who do not believe? May I just suggest something to you? Those with a good and honest heart, just like the parable of the sower says, those with a good and honest heart, they're going to hear the word and they're going to believe. Those who do not have a good and honest heart are going to hear the word, the same exact word, and they are not going to believe. The servants, nothing is mentioned about the servants. Can you imagine being one of these servants? You've been told to fill up these water jars with water and then take the water to the master of the feast. They're probably thinking, he's going to rip our heads off. Nobody was going to want to drink water. They knew what happened. But nothing is mentioned about them and their belief. But the disciples, those who wanted to know more, those who just a few days prior had said to Jesus, "Where are you staying?" And he replied, "Come and see." And they spent the rest of that day talking to him, getting to know Jesus. And when you get to know Jesus, if you have a good and honest heart, you're going to do exactly what John said in John 2. That is, you're going to believe. I have thoroughly myself, and I'm not done preaching from the Gospel of John yet, but I have thoroughly enjoyed getting into the depth of just these first couple of chapters. I haven't even gotten through all of chapter 2 yet. We've spent a lot of time in chapter 1, so much there. But I've gotten to know and appreciate Jesus on a more intimate level. Can you say the same thing? How are you spending your time? If you spend your time with Jesus in His Word and getting to know Him like John wants you to, then it cannot do anything but affect you to where you would believe more in Him and appreciate what He has done. John is writing this post-resurrection. He's writing this from the standpoint of, we already know the story, we already know what happened. He writes this towards the end of the first century. And so he makes all these connections, all these references that allude both to the Old Testament and to what we know is coming in the story because we've already heard the story before. He says, "This is the Christ. By believing in Him, you may have life." Won't you come to Jesus tonight? Won't you believe in Him? See who He is, see what He brings, experience what He brings. He has brought you something new, something better, and He is wanting to dine with you. He is wanting to feast with you. That's what we have to look forward to as His disciples. Come and confess your faith and be baptized and live for Him. Won't you come as together we stand and as we sing.